Hello and welcome everyone to an incredibly special intro and episode of MTG Potpourri. To bring you this amazing amalgamation of magic news, said it right, word of day calendar, I needed two exceptionally good co-hosts to help me do this. So going around our virtual roundtable, I have Connolly Woods.
And unfortunately, I was the only exceptional caster available, so we had to settle for a little less in other department. But I'm here to bring you all of the wonderful content you need and love.
Yeah, I just realized about half the time, Connolly, when I say your name, I add an extra syllable. I say Connolly.
Oh, everybody, yeah, that's like the most common, because like Jennifer Connolly and stuff like that. So I'm quite used to people calling me Connolly, but yeah, it's technically just two syllables.
I'm a professional, damn it, Connolly. Yeah, get it right. And know who always gets it right? It's Adam Staborski.
That is blatant lying. I am wrong so much it hurts.
All right, guys. Well, we're actually podcasting quasi 2 weeks in a row, so this is somewhat of a actually is special in that respect. But we have a brand new set, and Connolly.
You had it right. I'm pretty sure you were fine.
Just say Jennifer, so it's easier.
I'm going to be self conscious the entire episode. So, Connolly, you already mentioned that you had a little bit of a rant. So we're going to be talking, obviously, a little bit about Fate Reforged because we had the pre-releases. And some people may have been writing set reviews, and they might have not liked that for some reason that you're going to tell us about right now.
Oh, no. So I liked my set review. But so here's the thing about set reviews. First of all, let me explain magic design in general, or I guess you could even say larger card game design. The way that Magic the Gathering sets are designed is that the vast majority of cards are designed with limited in mind solely. They are not designed for anybody to necessarily pick them up and play them in high-level constructed play, but they are designed to balance and create a healthy and fun limited format. All the combat tricks and the random auras and all that kind of stuff that never ever sees play in constructed is there, so that way when you're drafting the cards, you have a healthy and awesome environment. And it, because you are playing with so many more cards during limited than you are in constructed, they have to dedicate a larger amount of the set to limited. I would say, on average, at least in terms of high-level competitive play, there of course are cards that are being printed that are for casuals or for EDH in mind or whatever. But that's a very small subset of cards per set, I would say. Most of the time that cards see play in those formats, it just because it happened to be so, they weren't specifically designed with EDH in mind.
I just want to interject quickly. I think a lot of people notice them more because they take up higher rarity slots, yes, as in they're not affecting limited environments and their premier cards shown off for previews.
Exactly. Whereas limited cards tend to be more common and uncommon naturally, so that way you see them more often in limited. I would say that in general, 10, at most, maybe 20% of the cards in a set are going to see constructed play ever in the life of Magic the Gathering. Not just like in Standard now, not just in Vintage or anything. Like, literally ever will see play in a competitive level. Like, I can go into Star City Games, type in this card, and it will not come up with a deck list for anything ever done with this card. Like, random 2/2s for the Grizzly Bears, for example. Grizzly Bears is a very popular, very known card. You will not see it in a Magic the Gathering constructed deck ever from this point forward. Like, maybe back in the day when there was only 100 cards available, but now that there are full large sets, you're just never going to see it. And so when you go through a set review, I try to do my set reviews not necessarily from my own voice, but kind of from a more neutral voice, because I particularly look at cards in a very different way than most people. Like, I see small opportunities for really niche, obscure cards to see play, and I tend to mention those in my set review, but I don't necessarily give the card like a 3 out of 5 or something when it's clearly everyone else is rating the card terrible. I'll give it like a 0.5 or maybe a 1 out of 5 and say, like, hey, I think there's a little bit of hope here for the card, but I'm not going to go and say it's going to define Standard or something absurd like that. For Fate Reforged specifically, I found the set to be extremely underpowered in terms of constructed quality, like, standouts. There are plenty of, like, little cards that will come in and do some cool things. There are plenty of cards that I give a lot of 3 out of 5s in the set, which is, like, standard standout, but not necessarily going to see play in a lot of other formats. It's not necessarily going to dominate standard by any means. It'll just be a card in these decks that'll be strong. And so I gave a lot of 3 out of 5s, a lot of 2 out of 5s, and things less than that. I didn't give basically anything in the set of 4 out of 5 or a 5 out of 5. And in my comments, there were a lot of people that were upset about that. They were claiming that
they rate you over the coals. Kind of, I'm reading through some of these.
Yeah, there are some people. Some people are like, you know, defending me, but there are plenty of people that are just like, you hate this set. Like, your ratings need work and stuff like that. But
I don't even think you read the cards, Conley. That's
exactly. A couple of times I do get cards wrong because I basically have the pre-release plus the spoiler that I've looked at to evaluate these cards off of. And so a couple times I'll mess up on a card like Heir of the Wilds was a famous one from Khans of Tarkir that I thought cost 4 mana. So I rated him unplayable and constructed because when he's a 4 mana 2/2, that becomes a 4 mana 3/3 with that touch. That's not good and constructed at all. Turns out when he costs half of that amount of mana, like he actually does, he's quite better. So I got that one wrong, but that was just because I just didn't know what the card did. Sometimes that happens. But in Fate Reforged, I didn't really rate any cards 4 or 5s, and people were upset about it. Like, oh, well, if you didn't give any cards 4 or 5s, your scale is wrong. But the thing is, you can't just look within this set at what cards are 4 and 5s. If I looked at just this set and everything was self-contained, that means I'm going to be giving cards 4s and 5s that in other sets would have been Bloodbraid Elf, would have been Jace the Mind Sculptor, would have been Tarmogoyf, cards that legitimately deserve 4s and 5s. 4s and 5s do not come around very often, I'll give you that. They are very infrequent, maybe once a year, maybe once every couple sets, something like that. But if you don't leave some room at the top for the Umezawa's Jitte, for the Cryptic Commands, if you don't leave some room at the top, then, you know, where is that space when those cards do show up? There are no cards that are Cryptic Command in Fate Reforged. There are no cards that are Tarmogoyf. There are no cards that are even Bloodbraid Elf. Bloodbraid Elf is a card I would consider a 4 because it defined Standard. It was pretty good in Modern, but it wasn't like game revolutionary in terms of like Vintage has changed, Legacy has changed, the way that a Tarmogoyf is or a Snapcaster Mage is or Jace the Mind Sculptor. Those are 5s. Those are cards that have changed Magic for the rest of Magic's life, basically. Whereas Bloodbraid Elf was extremely good, extremely popular in its areas. And then, you know, Cryptic Commander probably been a 4, stuff like that. But if you don't leave some room at the top there, and I just start giving out 4s and 5s to cards that I think are legitimately 2s and 3s just because they're in Fate Reforged, now my scale doesn't work across sets. And so I was certainly harsh on cards from Fate Reforged, but that's because I think the cards from Fate Reforged are very bad. I think a very small portion of the set is going to see play, and I think a lot of the cards that are going to see play are very, very niche, and they're going to see play maybe one deck, maybe some sideboard, stuff like that. And so I basically called it out, and I rated this set like that. But people were not happy with that, partially psychologically, because they just want to see higher numbers. They want to see the cards they like have higher numbers, and I understand that, but I don't want to just, like, basically, in a fake way, change my scale, manipulate it to where all of a sudden there's, you know, 10 fives in Fate Reforged and 12 fours and then 1,000,000 threes and there's basically no zeros, because when you do that, things don't really hold up. I went back and looked at my entire Khans of Tarkir review every single day, all 5 days, every single card in the set. I gave, of all the cards, I gave zeros, meaning they're constructed unplayable in every way, shape, and form. I gave 3 card zeros that are seeing play today. The first is Heir of the Wilds, which I told you I messed up on, and I would have definitely not given it a zero if I knew it cost 2 mana. The other 2 cards are Burn Away, which is an extremely niche sideboard card that's seen play as like a 1 or a 2 of, and it's only because the DC whip is a thing. And, like, I'll be willing to say I messed up on that, but I would have given it like a 0.5 or something. So it's like something very, very close to that. And then the other card is Feet of Resistance. Again, a very, very niche card sees play in one deck, and it sees play because it needs to be additional copies of God's Willing. And my main argument against the card was that God's Willing was significantly better, and they're both in, you know, close proximity to each other, so you really wouldn't play Feet Resistance over God's Willing. Turns out people want to play more than 4 God's Willing, so I understand. But both those cards, I think, were at least – there were some arguments for them to be zeros. I could have given them a 0.5. I could have given them a 1, but they were not 3s or 4s. And that was the entire set. Only 3 cards that I said were unplayable have seen play to this point. So I think that when people look back on things, it makes it a little more clear. But right now people are just like really gung-ho. They want their cards to succeed. They want their cards to be good. And I understand that. But I also don't want to like lie to people and tell them that these cards are like A-plus winners when in reality they're just not going to see any constructive play. So it puts me in kind of a really awkward spot where like I want to deliver a good product to people and I want people to be excited about the set. But I also don't want to just be lying to them and selling them. That's the other thing is when I promote every card as good. Like Khans of Tarkir, I give a lot of cards 4s and 3s and stuff just because there was a lot of really strong cards. And people accuse me of just trying to make TCG player money and sell cards. And it's like, well, which one do you want me to go down? Do you want me to be real with you in one way or the other way? So I don't know. It's a very frustrating place to be in. Doing set reviews is like one of the least appreciated possible jobs in all of the world of the Magic the Gathering content. Like podcasting, articles, videos, all that stuff is more fun and more appreciated than a set review, which you generally just get pooped on because I don't know. I think that I might want to like change to the Michael Flores thing where he kind of – not his exact skill, but instead of giving things numbers, he kind of gave them like he would call things role player or like flagship or something like that, to where you never knew if the card was like necessarily good or bad. You just knew what its role was. I don't know. Maybe I'll try something like that. But it's just a really weird place to be in. And I'm kind of up in the air about what I'm going to do for the next set in terms of my set review. But if anyone has any awesome ideas, feel free to comment them or whatever.
I don't know. I'm just having a hard time even listening to somebody that gave Treasure Cruise 2.5 unconstructed.
Yeah, like I give Treasure Cruise a 2.5 because, and in my review, I gave Peer Through Depths, or Dig Through Time, excuse me.
You said here, should be played every format. Or I guess it would until it got banned.
Every format. I said it'll see play in every format, and the reason that I didn't give it a higher rating, as I said in my description, was because I thought Dig Through Time was a better card and people would play that instead. I was wrong. Basically, Treasure Cruise is the more popular of those two. So if you actually flipped their ratings and you gave Dig Through Time the 2.5 and Treasure Cruise the 4 or whatever that I gave Dig Through Time, then like those ratings all of a sudden make sense. Basically, the only thing I screwed up was which one was going to be more popular, and you know, that's, I think, an honest thing to screw up. But it's not like I thought Treasure Cruise is going to be an impossibly terrible card. I said right in the description that I thought I was going to see play every format.
Yeah, it doesn't seem like fun, I'll be honest with you.
I mean, some people will like give you some feedback like, oh, you know, good review. I liked everything you wrote and stuff. But then there's just always like 10 people that just call out like the two cards they disagree with, and they claim your entire set review is trash because of these two cards that you disagree with. And then often they'll pick some card that like you're like, I gave that a 0 and it's definitely a 0. And then you'll read like the little paragraph that they have for why their thing's not a 0. And you're like, what? Like I'll literally go find one right now as we continue to move on to a different discussion, and I'll find a good one and I'll read it and give everybody a laugh. One second.
Okay.
All right. So while Conley's trolling. That might be a stretch. Well, trolling for trolling.
Yeah. You don't need to play Magic to get trolled. I got trolled in just normal everyday life this weekend. So.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know about that, but I am a cunning linguist. So. When I try to make it happen, Tom, it's not cool. I know. So I don't write set reviews. For Gathering Magic, I try to avoid set reviews. Like I've had the people in the past, like, you know, hey, like I'd really like to do a set review, and really there's only like two kinds of things that come out of set reviews. You have things like you know, things like Conley's set review, where it's like it's his opinion and perspective, and it's not meant to be a Bible for the set. It's his perspective and predictions to help inform you of his opinion of them. You know, and some people take that to heart and go off on a tangent. And then you have other things like, you know, things like LSVs and everybody else's that end up just feeding into kind of like this grinder, I want to call it, because that's what it is. It's this basically this aggregation sheet. That always pops up on Reddit, and somebody just pulls in all the cards and everybody's review and just basically says, okay, well, if we aggregate, you know, the opinions of the 8 different reviews that seem worthwhile, this is like the aggregated point, which doesn't really tell you much beyond, you know, do people generally are people generally positive or negative about a card. So again, it informs you even less about a card because it takes away all of the context that, you know, that somebody like Conley will write behind a card. So the two things that I do like set reviews for are art and kind of flavor and kind of looking at things that are not the physical card. There are things that in a general sense are okay to be, critical about and kind of point out. And you can kind of see some interesting things. Like I really enjoy like when people get high resolution art and they like see things like, the shark hidden in the tornado and the one Khonzatar Kir card. Noah Bradley put in. Like, I thought that was really cool. Like, you can't possibly see it on the card, but in the actual art itself, it's definitely a Sharknado. Like little details like that are cool, and they're kind of fun to point out. And the other one are cube reviews, because in that case, you are only comparing against kind of like the library of similar and powerful cards. And so then you end up with a much more objective discussion. It's like, these are the situations this card looks better. These are the situations this new card looks better. Which is that situation more common or not? You know, and then you get into the texture of, does this card support types of archetypes and drafts that are in this cube versus this other cube? And that's kind of where I'm very happy looking at all the commons things that I do with the Pauper Cube update. Alex Ullman and I worked together on the update this time. And, you know, I really like going over cards, like pointing out things like, hey, this card, you know, Erishin Cleric or wherever, like it's actually a foil version of Temple Acolyte. So like if you're using Temple Acolyte, which is, you know, just a 1/3 gain 3 life dude, it's just like a, you know, it's a nice little tempo buffer. Like, okay, I'm going to slow this other deck down, you know, but not threaten them while I do it. Now you have a foil copy available, or a second copy if you're into that kind of thing. And those kind of neat little things pop up and you know, they're more objective. You know, we're not looking at saying whether a card is in a future standard environment that, you know, tens of thousands of people are going to iterate on is going to be good or not. You know, it's a challenge that I, you know, I really don't think anybody alone can really truly tackle. So that's how I feel about set reviews. Did you find something awesome, Conley?
I did. Well, this one has a multi-tiered thing, so I was going to go through it. So I ignored the first half of this guy's comment because it's already too long. He says, sorry, Conley, but I just don't see reviews going out on a limb much. First of all, that's quite hilarious, directed at me. For example, you basically write off a 2/2 flyer with hexproof for 3 mana. That would be the aura that comes into play and manifests and gives your guy hexproof and flying. I don't know the name of it, but hopefully you guys do. He says, also has to be a chance to be something much greater while keeping its hex and flying once flipped. Invisible Stalker was a 1/1 hex with unblockable for 2 mana in a much faster format that required other cards to make it better, so you could say they are comparable since they have the same color. Invisible Stalker was a staple in Standard. First of all, Invisible Stalker was not a staple in Standard. It saw play in basically a deck and then a variant on that deck, which makes it a pretty niche card. Second of all, Invisible Stalker costs 2/3 of the mana of this, which is significant, and only a single blue, again, significant. Third of all, Invisible Stalker was unlockable always. Fourth of all, it was printed alongside Delver of Secrets and some insane equipment and auras that made it impossible to win the game when you did those things, none of which is true for 2/2 Flyer. So what people like to do, this is a very common occurrence, is they like to see cards that are printed today and they want to make comparisons to older cards. But oftentimes they make an extremely big leap here, comparing Invisible Stalker to a 2/2 flying hexproof, which has seen play by the way. We had a colorless white blue 2/2 hexproof flyer for 2, I think, or something like that, and it saw 0 play in the format. So like he could have made that comparison, but his mind didn't go to that. His mind went to the one possible playable card that has hexproof and a form of evasion that he can think that saw play, which was Invisible Stalker, and so he made that leap, and it's just way too big of a leap to make. From there, he goes on to say how, because I haven't playtested the cards, he can't take me seriously, which is obviously absurd considering it's before the set came out. And then he said, my rating system's been proven to be flawed based on history, which is why I went back and looked at all my cons cards and proved that wrong, even though I didn't tell him that. He then says that, like, there's no way the Blue Siege doesn't see constructive play in multiple formats, yet I barely give it a rating. The applications for that card are extensive. Any deck splashing blue would at least want to sideboard it when going against any burn deck. So what he's referring to here is the Blue Siege makes spells cost 2 more if they target you or a permanent you control. And the assumption he's making here is that I know I'm going against a burn deck, and therefore I could put some of these in my sideboard. I'll give him, if I'm playing a mono blue deck and you told me I was going to play against 7 burn decks today, I would put some of those in my sideboard. But the problem is the card is not good against almost any other deck. And so when you're building your sideboard, you have to rate the chance of you going against a burn deck by taking up slots in your sideboard and compare like whether it's worth it or not. And if you are maybe going to play 1 burn deck in a 10-round tournament, it's not worth devoting 3 slots in your sideboard to beating a burn deck, which means this card becomes not playable at that point. The card has to have multiple applications to be a really strong sideboard card and be good against multiple decks for people to really consider it. And that's one of those things where it's like, I thought of a use for this card, so the card must be good. But in reality, it's like, well, is that card more useful than other cards? What's the opportunity cost of that card? That's the most important thing. Are there other cards I could put in my sideboard that would do that thing plus additional things? Like Leyline of Sanctity, for example. Maybe I just play that in my blue decks because it's free and comes down on turn zero and I can't take any damage. Like, there's so much more to think about than just reading a card's text. You really have to compare the context of it, as well as the opportunity cost, and then you kind of figure out where cards, you know, give or take. And unfortunately, 3-mana 2/2 flying hexproof is just not a card that I think is going to see much play. It might see very, very niche play, but that's something that you can't really predict.
Yeah, one thing I'd just say in general, not digging into any of the specific comments I read through, is have you ever considered taking your constructed score and break it, basically subdividing it into like standard, modern, legacy? It seems like that was a lot of people's confusion. It's like, well, this card is, you know, great in standard. Why is it getting a 3? And you're just like, well, it's not a Jace. It's not a Umezawa Jite, which is going to be played in every single format out there.
Yeah, I definitely could. That would inflate it artificially to some extent. So there would be a lot more 5s and 4s floating around because some of these cards are, you know, 1s or 2s in standard, but, you know, with 0s overall. So I could theoretically do that. It's obviously a significantly more amount of work to kind of break it down into, I don't know, 3 or 4 formats, I guess. But I could do that. I could also just start rating things strictly based off of standard, and then if it has application in an older format, just kind of make mention of it in the notes or something, which would at least, you know, most people are concerned with standard and standard-like applications, if that makes sense. And then modern would be a smaller crowd is into that. But in terms of legacy or vintage, very few cards are even printed that have huge applications there. And when they do, I could potentially just call them out. So that's one thing I thought about doing. But I could do the breakdown into multiple formats as well.
Okay. I read quite a few of these set reviews just because I end up playing a little bit of limited in almost every set. And I do not feel like I have any ability in rating cards on a limited standpoint. So it is good to read some other opinions. I guess kind of for you, now that you've gone through and done your full set reviews, I mean, do you have a couple of cards that have maybe come up higher in your esteem for cards that you're really excited for from this set?
Well, you mean as a result of doing the reviews or as a result of like learning more about the cards since the review?
Kind of both. You know, just now that you've written reviews, we'll talk about.
There's a couple cards that I potentially rated a little low. The White Siege was a card that I debated giving a higher rating to. I gave Marshall... was it Martial Law, I think, the detain, it was like 4-mana enchantment at the beginning of upkeep, detain something. I rated that card as playable, and then I tried to play it in standard about a million times and was unsuccessful every time. So my backlash from that card wore off a bit on the White Siege, which is you can either choose to tap a creature on their turn or give something +2/+2 counters on your turn. So I rated that card as not very high. I don't even remember its exact rating, but basically not playable. When in reality, it might be slightly playable just because it does impact the board half a turn faster. So it might be see a little bit of play. I don't think it's a great card necessarily, but I do think it has a little bit of potential. There are a couple cards that when you don't necessarily or you haven't seen them in limited, you might underrate or overrate. So I'm sure I did that a few times. But then there are other cards like Outpost Siege that I gave a 1/2 in constructed, which I thought was being gracious. It's either you Chandra every turn or when your guys die, you deal 1 damage to a creature or player. I thought 1 was being pretty gracious on that card, and people were arguing that it was like a format defining card and you just play. They're all, you know, they tell me to play it with tokens. Of course, obviously I know to play with tokens, but it just does not seem like the type of card that's worth putting in your deck just because, you know, it just doesn't do what a deck wants to be doing. It's kind of like one of those big dream cards where the ideas that you have with the card are awesome, but they don't actually work in application very well. You know, there are plenty of cards that I'm going to get wrong by a point or two. I know that going in. It's certainly a tough job to guess where all these cards are going to be. But for the most part, I think that at least my written commentary is helpful. I generally try to point people towards like some interesting combos or interactions or whatever to try out with the card. So I think that overall I did a pretty decent job, although like I will admit that this set is pretty bad in general, and I did rate cards pretty low as a result of that, but that is what it is.
All right. I mean, Conley, do you and Adam want to talk about your pre-release experiences since you got to actually flop some of these cards on the table and make all types of upside-down stuff and manifest destiny jokes?
Why are you saying flop things on the table? I'm going to let Adam talk because I've been talking for a while and I need a break, but you should not use the term flop them onto the table.
I'm going to flop everything. I'm going to flop. Okay,
Adam. The preferred term is manifest, Tom. You manifest cards onto the table.
Or morph it.
Or just cast them.
Or cheaty face it onto the table.
Cheaty facing is the best.
Yes.
Except if it's not the actual card cheaty face.
That was half the fun of that card. Especially now, imagine with manifest, morph, and cheaty face playing like unhinged, unglued. Oh, that would be amazing.
That's actually a brilliant idea for my next wacky draft. thank you. So I really enjoyed the pre-release I went to. I went to a 6-round pre-release. It's a smaller store. It was a 45-minute drive for me. But a lot of my buddies that I draft with, and they're pretty competitive guys, go there. And the basically the prize payout started at 4 wins. So you play a 6-round tournament. You've got to win 4 of those rounds to get anything. So right there, I knew I was going to be playing people that we're willing to commit that kind of effort and thought to playing. Because that's one of the criticisms some people will bring to the pre-release is, it's not a very good way to play. People aren't really trying or just a fun, it's just a fun thing.
That's the only reason I ever even want to go to a pre-release. What you just
mentioned. Yeah, it's just to have fun. So I don't get to compete in very many events. So I like the opportunity sometimes to really kind of push on my limited side, because it's something that I really enjoy and I like being good at, and getting a lot of good feedback and discussion around the new cards immediately was something I was really looking for to help inform my Pauper Cube update. Because I have ideas, but again, as Conley's pointed out over and over, when you play with a card or when you predict something, you're only getting that piece of it. Like, you really need to actually play the card out and iterate on it to get to where it's going to be. So, six round tournament may not necessarily sound like a fun pre-release, but the way the limited environment played out, it was a lot of fun. Oftentimes, I was really impressed by Dash, the old Mardu, the old Tarkir Mardu ability, if you will. I was really surprised with how well it could do things. I had Kolaghan, the red black dragon, so I could dash him for 5 mana. Punch in with a 5/5 that's also pumping all of my other dudes that are attacking, and go into a situation where, like, you can alpha attack me, and if you don't kill me, like, you are just absolutely dead next turn, like, and kind of shut off the attacks. Situations where I saw a guy, cards like Auriform and the card you were thinking of, Cloudform, Conley, the 2/2 Hexproof flying. I saw those cards do some really disgusting things. Manifest really impressed me, especially when you manifest a flying lifelink creature that turns out to be a Pinewalker. Just the upside is so high on Manifest, but it's super swingy. And I think that's what I really enjoyed about it. Like, it felt really bad to get, like, my soul crushed by the turn one Ghost Fireblade, turn two Soul Summons, turn three Aura Form, and just have infinite that dudes just to beat me down with in 2 games. But the fact that could happen kind of counterbalanced against all the times it just turned out to be 2/2 lands. Manifest was kind of the effect that the pre-release boxes were kind of really good at showing off. So typically with Sealed, you'll have 3 packs of each set, or 2 packs of each set in a 3 set block. But the pre-release pack was, 2 packs of Cons, a seeded pack, which had some Fate Reforged in it, and 4 packs of Fate Reforged. So you had a lot of Fate Reforged coming in. It's a small set. Manifest is a part of that. So basically everybody was playing Manifest cards. So I just went all in and played all of the Manifest cards in the colors I was playing, which was Mardu, so it was not much, unfortunately. I did not have a very good pull, despite my dragon kind of carrying me in a couple of matches. But But playing with Manifest was really interesting. I still don't have a sense on how good it is. And I think it's that's going to be that way for a while. It's just so random. Evaluating the, you know, what a soul summons can really do. You know, making a 2/2, or maybe it morphs something. You don't know. It was just a lot of fun. Having that really swingy kind of back and forth crazy games happening all around, and the discussions that came from the guys, especially those that drafted afterwards, was really interesting to listen to, you know, as they're all sorting through all the information they just gathered too. And a ton of cards made my Pauper Cube update, you know, for as much as sets may not be making a big enough impact on Standard and Modern and things like that. You know, from Conley's perspective, I think the limited cards are real standouts. There's just some really good stuff. Even Surveyor and Sandstep Outcast, and just every, you know, it seemed like the colors that didn't get some really sexy tools in Constantine Cure got some love. I especially really feel like Jeskai decks are really going to enjoy what they get from a Fate Reforged pack, and I think it's going to do some really good things for limited. Like, I'm really excited to do some drafting and really see how the whole set plays out, kind of as it's intended, more or less.
All right, Conley, how about for you? Were you able to hit a pre-release, or what was your kind of your first experiences with the set?
Yeah, I went to a pre-release with some friends. I ended up going Abzan as my thing. The pre-release is always a little weird these days, just because it's a little manufactured compared to the normal set, so you can't necessarily draw conclusions that apply to the limited format in general, just because you have things like guaranteed mana fixing or like a guaranteed rare that's in your color, stuff like that. But, you know, you still get to see how some of the cards play out and interact with each other, which is nice. Manifest, I don't know. I'm not as gung-ho on it as Adam. I still think it's kind of a clunky mechanic. Win paired with Morph. If either one of those had existed by themselves in this set, I would have been pretty happy. But pairing them up, even though they do have some nice synergy in terms of, like, you know, as Adam mentioned, Ghostfire Blade or random when this thing is flipped face up type cards, it does make for a pretty confusing board state at times. Sometimes people just have, you know, three or four face down creatures on each side of the table, and one or two of them are manifested and one or two of them are morphed, and it's pretty taxing on a player, even especially a newer player, I have to imagine, or they're just not thinking about it.
Just to jump in with addendum, I agree with Conley. I did, you know, if I sounded like I was super super up about Manifest, I don't think it's clunky per se, but just super swingy. Like, it just,
oh, sure, sure, you
know,
sure.
I just don't know where it actually sits yet, and I think that's just part of the mechanic. It's just super, that's random fair. Miracle.
That's fair. Yeah. It's also a very much a limited mechanic, I would say, outside of some very cheaty face applications in Legacy or Vintage, where people are trying to put Dreadnoughts into play and ignore their negative comes into play abilities, stuff like that. It's basically just a limited mechanic, which is, you know, kind of frustrating, because Morph's also just a limited mechanic for the most part. Dash is also kind of a limited, like, there's a lot of limited only mechanics in the set. Not too much going to see. That's probably part of the reason why the set's overall pretty low in power level for Constructed. It's just because a lot of the core mechanics are designed to improve limited play, and not necessarily, like, you know, the Dredge mechanic had some pretty good limited applications, but that was very much a Constructed level mechanic that broke. Obviously, you don't want to do things that extensively, but when it comes down to, like, cycling and morph and bloodthirst and, like, things like that, like, basically, if a card with those mechanics makes it into Constructed, it's making it there based on the strength of that card individually, not based on the strength of the keyword or whatever. So generally, you know, a Dash card, for example, is not going to see much play in Constructed unless it's good on its own. So the Dragon will probably see play, because that guy's just like Demigod Revenge. I would say that the 2-mana 3/1 in red will see play, but you're not going to see a lot of these, like, you know, the guy that makes things not be able to block, or, you know, the guy that loots or whatever. Like, those are not going to really see Constructed play just because they're designed for limited. But, you know, overall, I would say that the set played pretty well. It was a little weird to have guaranteed fixing, just because it felt like everybody was basically a three-color deck, and because they were basically the deck that their box enabled them to be. Not too many people really were willing to break into four or five color builds or even go against what their box told them to be. And like, I just happened to open up better Jeskai cards, so I'm Jeskai when I was supposed to be Sultai. Like, sometimes that happened, but people weren't really willing to, because all the things in front of them were pointing at just, you know, just stick to this three color deck. Here's a mana fixing for you. Here's your banner. Here's your rare. And so people kind of just followed that, which is fine.
I think you'll be proud of me then, because I went Sultai, because I'd done Abzan at the last one. I kind of wanted to do Mardu, but I always end up drafting. I draft a lot of red decks heavily, so I really wanted to try a different clan. Like, Sultai is one that I've avoided, and Delve, I really didn't have a good handle on until late into the format. So I went Sultai, opened it up. I got the only mana fixing I got for Sultai was precisely the one land that the one tri land that came in my fixed pack. And I had a foil Tasigur, but my mana fixing, my good removal and cards, everything else pushed me into Mardu. So I ended up playing a Mardu deck with basically a one trick pony, Kolaghan. And that's how I ended up, making it to 3-3, nearly lost the last two rounds to win anything, but turned down Tasigur and a bad Sultai deck for the better Mardu deck that actually won games.
And I actually think I the reason I even bring this up, because normally I would be like, let's say this was a monocolored set, I'd be all for, you know, you opening up your blue pre thing and building, you know, blue base whatever, splashing some other color, and that was, you know, everything was pushing in that direction. That's fine, because when it comes to drafting the set and building seal to the set, you could do basically that exact same thing. My problem with the pre-releases for this more complicated three color wedge set is that I think it kind of gets players who are not as confident in their limited skills off to some bad behaviors, basically, that they then carry over to the actual limited format when it comes, which is just kind of like force this three color thing, you know, whatever, you know, you get your rare, go for it, just, yeah. And it doesn't really teach this dynamic kind of really involved limited format that this limited format actually is. You can end up dipping in and out of colors, going four or five colors, very often going two color aggressive decks all the time, and just knowing kind of where to highlight and what to hit on. I don't feel like the pre-release does a very good job of kind of ushering players to that level, which is kind of a tough thing to do, because you also need to cater to players who just have no idea what's going on, and you just want to sit down and play some fun Magic, and the pre-release is designed for them too. So it might just be the nature of the more complex three-color sets. Like, Return to Ravnica was very similar, except it broke things down into two-color sets, so you have all these options. Like, you really couldn't mess up. Like, you open up your Orzhov Guild, and you go blue-white, and you're still fine, because, you know, you had plenty of cards in those colors. Whereas the same is not true when it gets to three-color cards. So like I said, maybe it's just a function of the set, but I would like to see just a little bit of, you know, a little bit more of a leg up on here's how this limited format's going to go, because it's pretty tough to tackle. Maybe this does a good job. I don't know. If you're a newer player and you went to the pre-release and you've done drafts since the pre-release or sealed since the pre-release, and you felt like it helped you, I'd love to hear from you from my own personal perspective as a game designer. But in general, it felt like it was just teaching players how to get by through the pre-release and not how to, like, learn the set, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I kind of agree with you, Conley. From a broader standpoint, obviously the pre-release serves a variety of purposes. One is to show off cards in the set, so putting more cards in those players' hands lets them see more of the set. It lets them feel like they're getting more new stuff rather than just, you know, imagine going to a third set pre-release. And I think this is how it used to be, or maybe it was back in the days. You go to a third small set pre-release and you'd have two packs from that set. Like, if it was an official sealed event. So if you're going for the new cards and you want to see new stuff, 2/3 of everyone's pulls are things that you've already seen. So, from like a marketing and experience standpoint, you know, people are going to see new stuff. I think the pre-release is aimed towards player acquisition. So, like, the idea of kind of giving players a crutch, and it is, to lean on and say, okay, well, I've got Sultai and I've got good Sultai cards and I've got mana that helps me cast those. So at worst, they're going to have a not very good deck in a clan, but it's a deck and it works and it has exciting stuff for them to play in it. And I think that's an upside. From from a player that likes to learn limited environments and is actually focusing on trying to understand cards and where they fit into things, I don't make any generalizations from the pre-release to like draft or like sealed in general, because obviously it's, you know, this one was so heavily skewed towards Fate Reforged, but in terms of experiencing new cards and kind of getting an opportunity to play with them, it's one of the reasons I really like testing with sealed first, because you end up playing cards that you never normally would avoid in draft. You know, you can kind of choose the more powerful cards or kind of build a deck towards redundancy, and you may never have to play in a rage form or something like that. But in a sealed deck, you know, when sometimes you have to scrape to find, you know, a nice, your best, you know, 23rd playable, I feel like you can go on a limb a little bit more, and everybody's kind of in that same boat. So I really enjoy that aspect of the pre-releases. I see and play with a lot of cards that I may never have the opportunity to genuinely touch again in limited. It's a good confirmation that, hey, this card that kind of looks good on paper and might work on paper doesn't actually pan out the way you think it does. You know, you can kind of get ahead of the curve on that. So that's been my experience, for what it's worth.
All right, any other thoughts, guys, before we jump into talk about what cards you can't play anymore in Modern and Legacy and Vintage?
Well, now that you've already done the segue, now we literally just have to do that.
Mm-hmm. I have all the power, Conley. Don't doubt that ever. All right, guys. We had our big – what was the official date on this? Was it the 19th, I think, was the ban restricted list updated? So yes. As we mentioned, there's a couple of cards that, you know, on the surface seem pretty powerful, but apparently were in some ways warping the formats in both kind of Modern, especially, seem to be getting the most attention, but also Legacy and then Vintage as well. So Conley, Aaron, did you guys want to list, maybe start with Modern, sort of what has been banned? And also we got one card back, and it's a personal favorite.
Of course, it's a personal favorite. Here.
I mean, right. if you've been living under a rock, the ban changes are as follows. In Modern, Birthing Pod, Treasure Cruise, and Dig Through Time, all gone. In Legacy, Treasure Cruise, gone. In Vintage, Treasure Cruise, restricted. Yeah, that's how hard they came down on that bad boy.
Keep in mind that basically nothing gets banned in Vintage except for Shahrazad.
Yeah, that is the last bastion, and they're like, you could only have one, guys. That's how good this card is, just one. Okay.
So literally, even though it's a common, I guess you still need four for standard, but even though it's a common, you really only need to pick up one.
You'll be good. Make it a foil one. You know, treat yourself.
Foil ones, I'm sure, are absurd. I haven't even looked at the price, but I cannot imagine. No,
they dropped from like 18, 20-ish range, depending upon who you looked at and when, to about half that. So I traded for mine for an Anafenza, like straight up, like a week after the set was out. And so that was a favorable trade for me then, and it's still a favorable trade for me now. And I only have one copy that I now jammed into my cube. So, yeah, I need another one for Commander, so... Send me your extra Treasure Cruises, those of you that have foil playsets. Thank you.
To round out the rest of the bans, by the way, because we didn't talk about them yet. So in Modern, Dig Through Time and Birthing Pod are also banned. Oh, did you? I thought you just mentioned Treasure Cruise.
I said Birthing Pod, Treasure Cruise, and Dig Through Time. All gone.
Okay, you didn't mention unbannings then, is that right?
No.
Okay, I knew you didn't mention something. I thought you just were mentioning Treasure Cruise. All right, so in Modern, Golgari Grave Troll is off the ban list. This guy's never done anything dangerous in the history of his existence. So
besides being cool and fun to play.
Also, he's one of the key. Basically, the thing about Golgari Grave Troll is not necessarily the card itself. You could mostly ignore the text. Dredge. You basically just need to see creature type or creature, that it's a creature, and that it has Dredge 6, which is the largest dredge number of any dredge card. So basically it enables filthy fill up my graveyard decks more so than any other dredge card, which is why it was the thing that was singled out and banned. Personally, there are other cards from the dredge deck that are still on the ban list, like Dread Return, for example. So I don't know how significant Golgari Grave Troll coming off the ban list will be. Personally, I would have liked to see three or four cards come off the ban list that specifically we talked about Sword of the Meek coming off, or I don't know if it's Sword of the Meek or if it's Thopter Foundry, but one of those two cards is banned and the other one's not. I don't know which one it is, but basically restoring that combo. I think Sword of the Meek's the banned one. And then in Legacy, unbanned was World Gorger Dragon. So if people don't know why this is banned, I'll explain, because it's kind of a convoluted combo. Basically, the thing you want to do with World Gorger Dragon is get into your graveyard, then you want to return it to play with an effect that is a permanent. So specifically, the most common one would be Animate Dead. So you Animate Dead a World Gorger Dragon, and then here's what World Gorger Dragon reads for all you young kids. He's three colors, red, 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 7/7 flying trample dragon. So he's huge for his cost, so you know something's up.
He's a nightmare dragon.
Yeah, he is a nightmare dragon, you're correct. When he comes into play, you remove all other permanents you control from the game, and then when he leaves play, you return all of those permanents back to play. So basically, the way this works with Animate Dead is you bring World Gorger Dragon into play. Animate Dead is on World Gorger Dragon. World Gorger Dragon then exiles Animate Dead. Animate Dead then puts World Gorger Dragon into the graveyard based on the way it works, which then brings Animate Dead back into play, which then brings World Gorger Dragon back into play, and that'll go on forever. During every iteration, you're going to tap all your mana and do all your things that, because the permanents come back into play untapped, of course. So you're basically going to use this to generate infinite mana, generate infinite something, do whatever, and then at the end of this whole thing, let's say you had like an Ambassador Liquidus or something sitting in your graveyard, you would then return that with your Animate Dead with the last trigger as opposed to the World Gorger Dragon, then use your infinite mana to mill your opponent, for example, with Ambassador Liquidus, or kill them with a Master Core of some kind, or do something like that. So this was banned in Vintage, or this was restricted in Vintage for a while because people were using it with things like Bazaar Baghdad, so you would get a World Gorger Dragon into play on turn one and then potentially just Animate Dead it with Off of the Lotus or whatever and just get like a turn one win, or plus a bunch of free Bazaar Baghdad mills, so you just like win the game there. You basically with like a Mox or whatever, you get infinite mana, infinite Bazaar Baghdad mills, and you just win. So it was feared in Vintage for a while. It was banned in Legacy, I would say, mostly because of that fear, even though things like Bazaar Baghdad are not legal. It is now coming off of the banned list. It should not be a big factor, I would imagine. It's basically a graveyard-based combo that is weaker than all the other graveyard-based combos, so I can't imagine it doing much, but That's the backstory. We'll see if World Gorger Dragon does anything. And then in Vintage, Gifts Ungiven, everyone should know what that card does. It is no longer restricted. Gifts Ungiven was actually restricted back in the day when my fellow Coloradan and friend Travis Spiro won the Magic Vintage World Championships with four Gifts Ungiven in his deck. Gifts was basically the everything card. You use it to set up – I mean – basically, the way the card plays in Vintage is everything in Vintage is a one-of because everything's restricted. So when you cast a Gifts Ungiven, you can do almost anything with it. You can grab a bunch of counter spells to make sure you're countering something. You can grab a bunch of draw spells to help you find your combo pieces. You could just grab your combo a lot of the times, depending on what your combo is. People would use things like Tinker plus Time Walk plus – I mean, in Vintage, you're getting like absurd piles of cards, and your opponent's like staring at them like, do I give him the Yawgmoth's Will and the Necropotence, or do I have to, you know, it's like a completely frustrating card to play against. It has not really seen much play as a one of, so it got unrestricted, I guess, to see if the deck kind of comes back. I don't know if it'll be a factor these days, just because Vintage has changed quite a bit in the last when he won the championships. It was like, I want to say 6 years ago, maybe 5 years ago, but it was quite a while ago. And I don't know if the format will be as open to a Gifts Ungiven type card, just because four mana is quite a bit in the format. The format sped up quite a bit. A lot more creatures seeing play, things of that nature. And Gifts Ungiven was usually a very, very controlling type of card deck where you basically sit back and like set up your Mindslavers and do whatever. But yeah, it's we'll see. I don't know if any of those unbannings will have impacts. I would have liked to see them be significantly more liberal and unban a bunch more of their stuff. But if nothing else, the bannings have definitely shook things up, at least back to where they were 3 months ago. So I guess we'll see where it goes from there.
So for you guys, are these exciting, not exciting? Were you happy to see the, you know, before we started the podcast, I was mentioning Red Blue Delver because I was mentioned prominently in the Wizards of the Coast article. I mean, do you guys feel this is a healthy change? I mean, Conley, you said you wanted to see more stuff unbanned. It sounds like you wanted to be shook up even better, more at this time.
Basically, I want Modern to just have more interesting decks, and I think that a lot of the cards banned kind of kind of create a restriction on the decks that see play as opposed to being more open. Like, if you just unban any one powerful combo piece, then that's bad because that combo deck becomes rises to prominence and, you know, crushes everything. But when you unban three strong combo pieces that go into three different decks, plus you unban Jace the Mind Sculptor, let's say, plus you unban Bloodbraid Elf, let's say, now we have a format where you have Bloodbraid Elf sitting next to Jace the Mind Sculptor, sitting next to three insane combo decks, sitting next to, you know, maybe some other strange card that kind of builds its own archetype, and you introduce that into a format where there's already these cool decks going on, and now you have, like, the general power level of the format overall has increased, but you haven't necessarily, like, teetered the scale towards any one deck. You're basically just like, we're infusing the format, here's a bunch of cool cards you haven't got to play with in a long time, they're not strong enough for Legacy, but they're cool in Modern, so let's showcase them. That's kind of where I want to see the format, and when you're banning three cards and unbanning one basically poopy card that I don't think is going to see much play, the format doesn't actually become much cooler. Like, the banning Birthing Pod makes sense, because if Birthing Pod's around, every mid-range green deck wants to be a Birthing Pod deck. I understand that, but at the same time, like, you've eliminated Birthing Pod, and what decks are going to be? We're going to get Rug and Zoo, maybe, as, like, our two green decks, probably, and then we're going to have, you know, the same Storm shenanigans, Pyromancer Ascension shenanigans, Affinity, like, the same decks that have been around in Modern forever. Grave Troll's not going to really introduce anything to that. So I would just like to see a little bit more diversity. In terms of Legacy, I think there's all kinds of cards that are on the level of World Gorger Dragon where they're basically 100% safe to come off the ban list and would see zero play, but at least would maybe let those people that really like those cards play them. So I just really want to see Legacy just a ton of stuff come off the ban list. And in terms of Vintage, I really don't know the metagame well enough to say what can and can't come off, but I guarantee there are plenty of cards on the restricted list that could come off and not harm anything as well. The thing is, like, these formats just change so often that, you know, having a ban list that stays stagnant for years, like the Modern ban list, this is like the second unbanning since basically the format started. Like, the format's so different now than when the format started, and this is the second card to get unbanned. Come on. It's a little crazy.
All right. Let's bring it up. Let's bring it positive. Adam, before we move on to I don't play a ton of Modern. If I have an Ornithopter and an Soul Artifact, I'm pretty much a happy guy. That's about the level of my aggressive, highly tuned Modern play.
Well, do I have the deck for you?
I was going to say, I literally lost to that deck in Omaha.
It's a fun deck. I mean, just for me, there's this, you know, this little part of you that enjoys having a 5/5 Vault Scourge or Ornithopter or Memnites, wherever the hell you're running in your mono blue funky and Soul Artifact deck. But it's just fun. It brings back that little bit of the flavor of playing Unstable Mutation, which is arguably one of my favorite Magic cards of all time. I mean, I guess, Conley, have you ever had the pure joy and satisfaction of playing an Ornithopter and then putting an Unstable Mutation on that Ornithopter?
I actually built a deck for my friend at Regionals that was blue-black, like, aggressive like this. It had Flying Man and it had Unstable Mutation. These were both when they were reprinted in Time Spiral, in the time-shifted pink things. It also had, like, it just had all kinds of, oh, Vexing Sphinx was in that deck as well. 3 mana, 4/4 flyer, and at the beginning of, you had Cumulative Upkeep, discard a card, and then when he died, you drew as many cards around his Cumulative Upkeep. So the way that works is you could always, like, put a counter on him on your upkeep and then not pay, so you draw one extra card off of him, which is kind of nice. But it had all these, like, super aggressive blue dudes, Unstable Mutations, and then 4 Commandeers in the main deck. And you would basically just, like, try to take the one important spell your opponent casts, like a Loxodon Warhammer or whatever, and then just beat down with your Flying Man. It was not a good deck, but I remember this deck because we called the deck, my friend's name was Jet, and we called it Jet's Mom, because we just had a ton of jokes about how it kept getting beat by everything, and so just over the entire
little black and blue bruising. I get it. Exactly. Go down the hole.
So all weekend we just, like, teased him and made mom jokes, and it was great. The joys of being a 20-year-old Magic player.
I am fortunate by that.
I was actually probably like 18 at the time, but yeah.
That treasure accrues as sale for me.
So I've got probably the most selfish, lamest answer for why I am happy Birthing Pod finally got banned. I was a little surprised, actually, because it had been on been around for so long. It had demonstrated its capability through numerous Grand Prix, through numerous diverse top eights. I mean, the top eight in Omaha had seven different archetypes. And Amulet Bloom, a deck that it was funny, when Matthias was playing it, I saw some of the usual type of prominent Twitter folks, Twitter pros, some of them made some fun about the deck. And it turns out it's a little more real than I guess people gave credit for. Made the finals. I looked at the daily deck lists for Sunday or Saturday, and a whole bunch had 4-0'd and 3-1 daily events. So it's just funny kind of how Modern had a reputation for being like Birthing Pod and Delver. But there's a surprising number of decks kind of under that surface. And I think Conley kind of hit it on the head why Birthing Pod finally went, because there's never going to be another non-green creature Birthing Pod deck. Yeah, that is just the best green creature deck you can make. So I have no better idea than Conley of where it goes from here. But the most selfish thing that I love about Birthing Pod being banned is typing deck lists. Birthing Pod deck lists are pretty close to Commander deck lists. It turns out when you have a four of engine that can silver bullet out answers and chain creatures up converted mana cost, you end up with a whole ton of one ofs. And it was just really frustrating to have 20% of the metagame, every metagame breakdown, all the top decks end up being these singleton nightmare decks that were difficult to double check, difficult to look over. So I am grateful I no longer have Birthing Pod decks to type up.
Which, by the way, is it's the same thing in Vintage. Every Vintage deck just is all one of them. It's quite miserable.
Yeah. So I mean, I think Birthing Pod is super sweet. I think it's still I think it's slightly underrated in Commander. I know a lot of Commander players don't necessarily talk about it all the time, or blue-black decks are kind of on vogue in terms of control and dominance. But an active Birthing Pod with ways to untap it in something like a Simic deck is just absolutely terrifying, and I've seen it do some really gross things. So if you love Birthing Pod so much and you're soul crushed that you can't play it in Modern anymore, just build a Commander deck with it. I think you'll be very happy. Your commander should be Isan, the Wandering Bard.
Or, I mean, if you want to go out on a limb, I think Birthing Pod is probably a Legacy-able card. Like, it is a card that could flagship a deck in Legacy if you tried hard enough and came up with enough cool interactions. Like, it is a powerful, powerful engine. And Legacy has shown us that you don't need to be the fastest deck in the world to necessarily compete, as long as you have a plan for that point in the game. Like, as long as you have a way to hold back the aggressive decks early on, you don't necessarily need to be the fastest thing in the world. Look at, like, Miracles was the best deck for a long time, and that was a very slow, grindy deck. Birthing Pod can very much be a similar thing. I don't know if it's worth it in Legacy, but I don't think many people have explored it. So if you really love that card, get out there and make it work.
Addendum. With Treasure Cruise gone in Legacy, I'd be surprised to see kind of the Jeskai blue-red flavor, blue-red splashing white flavor Delver decks kind of everywhere as much, especially as people probably go back to things like Stoneforge-based decks and things like that. So Wear and Tear is definitely a card, and I've seen it do some really good things against the Stoneforge decks, but if those decks come back, you might have a trump in something that lets you search up things that blow up their artifacts and give you creatures along the way. So I don't know. I have a hard time seeing a Birthing Pod in Legacy, but I think I would like to see it there.
All right, Adam. I've got something from Gathering Magic I want to talk about.
Oh, no.
Besides, is this something brand new that on your logo that you had the little subphrase, explore the game? I swear to God that wasn't there before.
Yeah, it's new.
That's new. Okay, good. I just want to make sure I didn't have a little TIA or something. Okay. So top eight community members. So this is from a fellow Minnesotan, Mike Linneman. I just want to see if you wanted to maybe share this so people could put their nominations in.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty straightforward. This is this is kind of Mike Linneman's baby. He's doing some work with some Grand Prix organizers, and he has some opportunity to share some really cool experiences at potentially some of the really large U.S. based Grand Prix coming up. So basically, he wanted to provide a way for people that really feel that somebody's doing some good in their Magic community and is local. You know, there are a lot of these guys, you know, like I know one that used to matter for me, and he was the guy who organized the local casual night. So like when I first got back into Magic for like the fifth time and the last time that I got back in, because I never left again, he was one of the guys that showed me around, introduced me to people, got me up to speed on kind of the intricacies of what the popular formats were that people were playing and what the differences were, explained to me Elder Dragon Highlander and why I might like it and what was tough about it. Just really did a lot of work organizing all of these guys and making an awesome community. And this is when and it still is the case, that the Thursday night casual crowd just dwarfed Friday night Magic. And typically it's, you'll hear that it's the other way around, but just the community that he built up was awesome. And Mike just wants to be able to kind of give a chance to give basically just like a super powerful shout out and recognition for those guys and girls that have really put in the effort to make, make Magic awesome. It's really easy to just look at like the Magic Online Community Cup. Well, it's people that stream Magic, prominent pros that have done streaming and commentary, community members, people that run websites and make videos. They're all people that we see and know, but they're not necessarily somebody who's really made a difference in our magical life, personally and directly, and especially to a large group of people at a local store or community center. Things like that. So that's what it's just all about. And that's totally Mike. Mike just kind of came out of nowhere with it for me, and he wanted to take charge and really put something out there for those people. So that's all that is. That's, if you know someone or you think that someone's made a real positive difference to your Magic community, Mike wants to know about it and hopefully wants to give that person basically just a big virtual high five for it.
All right. So it seemed very cool. I will put a link in the show notes. So if you have a person like this in your life or in a community you want to share, throw it in as a Google Forms, like a Google Forms doc. Easy to do. Put your nomination, tell a good story, and hey, maybe they will get something out of it.
Yeah. And somebody had a really great question, like, hey, I really hope you don't have to supply, the address for this person or the address for me who's nominating, and you don't. None of the forms are required. Really, we just want to try to make sure we avoid any weird trolling or situations where people put in a whole bunch of fake people or have a backup way of contacting them, because we're not asking for phone numbers. Ideally, we're going to reach out. And I say we, I mean Mike is going to contact people on social media, but when worst comes to worst, they can send a letter in the mail, and I think all of us can kind of attest, like, a handwritten letter in the mail is something you always open. So I think that's just the kind of like the last ditch point of contact it's a nice to have. So don't worry if you don't know somebody's home address or anything like that. We're not looking to find people to stalk. It's more just, making sure we have a real authoritative way to contact them and let them know somebody thought they were awesome.
Okay. Very cool. Guys, we're at the end of the show. We've actually been going for like an hour and 15 minutes, which is fairly impressive, because we're actually done this almost 2 weeks in a row. So you think we would need a couple of months to build up that sort of amount of content?
No, but I've been working out so that I could do it more often now.
You could do it twice on Sundays. All right. Adam Conley, any last things you want to mention, share, plug?
Not really. Go check out my articles on TCG Player and channelfireball.com. Twitter is @Conley81.
And you guys are both going to a GP this weekend. Is it the same
team? Oh, yeah, we are. It is. San Jose.
Yep.
I don't know who my third team member is yet, so that'll be exciting.
It cannot be me, and moreover, I'm probably sure you wouldn't want it to be me.
You should do like Happy Gilmore, where you would like hire sort of like a homeless person off the street to be part of your team. I think that would be cool.
I don't think that would be very cool, but it would be something.
Be giving that person a potential life-changing opportunity. It'd be sort of like The Blind Side, but with magic.
Wouldn't it be better for me just to, like, it would be, like, from a game perspective, it would be better for me to, like, find the best magic player possible, compete in a tournament, and then offer to give all my winnings to the homeless person because then you have a better chance of getting money.
But it's – even though I'm not a religious person, I've been told, Conley, that I can either give somebody a fish and eat for a day or I can teach that person to fish or play magic.
I don't think teaching a homeless person to play magic is the most profitable use of their time.
I'm an optimist, Conley, if you haven't gotten that in all of our conversations. All right.
Stay in school, do not drop out, and live on the street and play magic.
Yeah, how many of my life lessons have come from Adam Sandler movies? It's quite a few, actually.
I don't trust penguins that I see in my hallucinations.
I was thinking about Mr. Deeds, and were they, again, what are you going to do with your $30,000? I'm going to buy a giraffe. I'm going to drop out of school. Look at me, school's for fools. Where the homeless guys basically tell them they should stay in school. And I thought that was a good lesson. I waited until the end to destroy the podcast, which is pretty good for me.
It's beautiful. That was your discipline tonight made me very proud.
Thank you,
Tom. I'm Adam Szymborski.
Share your stuff. Blood type, social security numbers.
You can shout at me all you want on Twitter, the_Stybs, STYBS. That's usually a good way to get a hold of me, especially when I'm like dying of the flu, like I was part of last week. So,
you must not have been actually dying. At least you'd be dead.
Yeah, I didn't actually die. Okay. Pretty hard to kill, apparently. Human body is resilient. Amazing thing. I love Popper Cube, so keep an eye out for the Popper Cube update. It'll definitely be up by the time the podcast goes up. So if you want to see what commons are awesome and why I spend so much time paying attention to the cards that aren't revealed until the actual last day of reveals. You know, I can tell you why. If you haven't picked up, Grand Prix San Jose is team limited. As kind of Conley pointed out, he's looking for a third teammate there. I wouldn't bombard him with requests. He knows what he's doing. He's a big boy. But team limited is great because it's offset against Grand Prix Mexico City, which is actually just regular limited. So both days are going to feature sealed on day one. However, the context of the sealed is going to be different. And live video coverage is only going to be available from San Jose, as far as I'm aware. So you'll be able to see awesome teams coming together with really interesting decks. I think the power level in Team Sealed is always a little higher because of the ability for three people to build consistent decks and kind of share the colors and farm out different things appropriately is always really interesting. You know, you have more choices to pull from, and therefore decks theoretically kind of rise with that ability to have redundancy and consistency spread across them all. So I'm really excited to see kind of what pops from Fate Reforged and how many teams have a manifest deck that's just doing something squirrely with face down stuff all the time. The draft at the end of the day, the finals drafts should be awesome. And I know that I'm almost positive they'll show a live draft. So if you've been waiting to see some really high level Fate Reforged draft, team draft is going to be sweet because they're going to show you which cards people are looking to have in their decks and which cards they're not willing to let anyone else, any of their opponents get a hold of. And I think that dynamic is always really awesome in Team Sealed. So Team Limited. So I'm really excited for this weekend. So I hope you tune in and read up.
All right. And for me, you can contact me at Twitter. I'm Tom. At PSG Reader or Passage Reader, if you are a Conley and somewhat illiterate, or you can email at the official MTG Potpourri email address, which is mtgpotpourri@gatheringmagic.com. And I don't write anything, so, well, besides every random things on Twitter and the incredibly brief show notes that I do for this show every single 1 to 2 months.
Those are important show notes, Tom.
They're pretty good. Have you noticed I always include one kind of fun picture?
Oh, yeah, of course. I check out our show notes that after they go up on the internet all the time. Why wouldn't I do that? That's what you do. Of course.
Yeah, because this time there's going to be a picture.
I don't even know what website we go on.
It's the KFC Double Down Dog. It's only available in the Philippines, but it's a hot dog where the bun is a chicken breast filet thing.
I have to admit, I am bitter. It is not available here.
Yes.
Like actual bile from my gallbladder, bitter. Just I want something that ridiculous. I mean, I'm also like the guy that's like a double down sounds great. Why isn't there a double down?
I'm pretty sure you could go pick up the ingredients at your local supermarket and make a double down.
But I can't have an angsty teenager serve it to me with indignant rage that he's sublimated.
We have plenty of angsty teenager listeners. I'm sure we could hire one of them.
Put on a little uniform. You can bring out.
Or you could do the homeless guy thing that I was going to do for my team sealed. You could do that. He could cook you a double down.
Yeah,
I'm not going to pay a homeless person to handle.
According to Tom, it would. You were teaching him to fish by.
Useful life skills.
Yeah,
giving a homeless man a pot of boiling oil and raw chicken does not sound awesome.
Yeah, it's fun for the whole family. Your kids can see you helping. They can help out.
Oh, and you get to teach them how to spell salmonella.
Yeah, because you know a 3 to 4 year old totally knows to wash their hands after handling any sort of raw chicken or poultry.
Hey, how many people do you think they turn on our podcast and then they just keep skipping forward until they hear us arguing back and forth and then they listen from that point forward?
I would
anytime there's the long they like skip like long monologue keep going and Tom mentioned diapers and we're good to go.
Here we go. Here's our last 15 minutes of just pure trash.
I don't know. I'd like to imagine there are 3 MTG Potpourri listeners, and maybe listeners, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I think there are 3 types. One that's like, I like all these guys. I think they all bring something interesting to the show. The dynamic works. Everybody has different opinions. They're willing to express them, but they're not like drunken raging at each other about it. You know, so you get a good dynamic, and they actually enjoy the complete package that is MTG Potpourri. Then there's the type that I think hate any one of us, and so like when Conley goes off on a rant, or like I start talking about like Commander and my obsession with commons, they just kind of skip past that, kind of like what Conley was saying. And then I think there is that third listener that's like, where did Tom send this off the rails? And that's all they look for. They're like, why isn't there like a highlight button where it's like, just give me the minutes when Tom said something ridiculous and everything went to hell. And then they try to find those moments. I'm pretty sure that's like the third type of listener. I think that's the listener that emails Tom and encourages it because that's what they want. They just want to get fed with more ridiculousness.
I guess we could add that to the show notes. Kind of, hey, this is where the magic content clearly ends.
No. It's a great Easter egg. We want people to listen to more of our stuff.
It's like
that's part of the charm is it always starts out so well. And then sometimes it starts out and Tom immediately veers off. And then other times they've got to wait all the way to the end. And
You guys might not realize it, but we're damn disciplined. We get through that first 75% pretty much unscuffed every time.
I'd say it's pretty rare that I can really derail it too much in the middle, unless we're talking about like 90s Donruss or something. But we lost that part, so we did okay.
That's true. We did. We derailed it at the start of the show last time, and it got cut off.
And then the computer didn't work.
God himself was like, "No, Tom," and that still doesn't stop you. It's amazing. I love it.
And then, there's also you forgot about the fourth type of listener, which is Marcel, and he'll just listen because he's Marcel.
Yeah, Marcel's awesome. I'm going to take total credit that I discovered Marcel.
Marcel stayed at my place during GP Denver. We hung out.
Oh, really? I think when we did voicemails on Monday Night Magic, that's how we discovered Marcel.
Yes, it was way back in the day when we had people call in and do terrible, like fuzzy, you can't barely hear what I'm saying voicemails.
Yeah, Marcel from Oakland. And then he joined the podcast. And then for literally a month, I thought he was black.
We literally put on a show where like the topic was like racial insensitivity.
That's right.
We were reading letters and then we're like, Marcel, we think this to be a more appropriate topic for you to handle.
Like, why do you keep giving me all the black?
Yeah, and he's like, all right, I guess. And he reads it, and at the end of the show, he's like, guys, just so you know, I'm not black. Right? And we're like,
oh. Yeah, whatever. You're kidding. No, actually, I'm not. Oh, I'm sorry. Like, where the hands go up by your mouth, you're like, I'm sorry.
I would have bet the entire farm on it prior to that conversation with him.
That was probably one way. Yeah, personal favorite moments of Monday. that's probably pretty high up. Oh, I'm sorry, I racially profiled you. Excuse me. Right, Adam. Did you think we'd go there? Did you think we'd end up on racial profiling at the end of this podcast?
No, and that's why it's a delight every time. Not that we end up with racial profiling, but because we end up somewhere like that. I just want to add that I've gotten to cast with Marcel before on Monday Night Magic, and I think I've been on Brainstorm Brewery once, maybe twice.
Yeah, you did join us on Monday Night Magic once. Well, I forgot. Yeah.
Yeah, there's like a good 6 month stretch where I was in there.
It helps when you did it for like six damn years, or something probably is going to happen within that range.
but I've always just admired his voice. Like, I wish I had that kind of audio, you know, verbosity. I don't know how to put it. Just always, it's just a very distinctive, great voice, and I've always really enjoyed that. And also he's a great person to work with for Brainstorm Brewery. So Gathering Magic helps publish Brainstorm Brewery podcast, and
which I was on week ago. So go check out that one.
Yeah, set review, verbal.
Yeah. It was.
Worse. If you're illiterate, this is for you.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I mean, we didn't really go over every single card. We kind of just talked about specific cards and stuff like that. But it was fun. It was different. It was definitely different than this show. Although I'm pretty much always me, so there's that.
Stay true to yourself, man. That's another proverb I heard. Just, you know, be you. There's nobody better at being you than you, Connolly. All right, guys. But thank
Marcel's
you.
Marcel's a pro, and I love him.
So. Yeah. And I'm not, so that's how you get MTG Potpourri. So, Adam Conley, thank you again very much. It's always fun. So, if you're in the Philippines, get a KFC Double Down hot dog thing and tell me what it tastes like.
I'm sure we have a bunch of Filipinos.
Hey, I'm running at Magic. We had a fairly, at least, I mean, this is like 3 years ago, but at least when I was last here, we actually had a fairly international flavor to the audience.
But Tom, we're has-been. We're washed up.
Is that does feel weird when I think about that. It's like, yeah. It's washed up from something that actually didn't matter at all. It's like, oh, it's kind of sad. And I'm not even sure what it's doing anymore. It is weird to like, have done something for 6 years and then now you're like, you don't know where it is. It'd be like having a 6-year-old and it just kind of left the house one day and you haven't seen it since.
What? I don't know how
Timmy's doing.
What happened to our child? It's gone forever.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Seems just
awesome.
Like yesterday.
My paycheck loves this.
It's not just yesterday he went out that screen door.
We had a cat do that. It like left when it was given birth. It like was in our house for like 6 months or something. Then it like left when it got big enough and then came back like 4 years later. It was pretty absurd.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And then we had it till it was like 12 and Henri and ate everybody.
Did you have like pictures? Like, how did you know it was the same cat?
It had literally all the exact same markings, including some really strange ones on his paws. It was the exact same colors, and its mother or whatever was still around, and like they had like the most intense relationship ever. So
that sounds gross.
No, not like that. Oh, it was okay. Just like always like clean each other, and like just out of nowhere, like a cat came back, and like that day it was like cleaning this other cat like in our house.
We're, not like usual new cat to do cat behavior. Usually they have to hiss each other like
exactly.
six weeks. Yeah,
exactly.
All right. Cats
hissing. Hey, we're going to end the show.
Finish this then. Yep, red cat's hissing. Where are you, Smush? Bye-bye. I'll stop it.